Well, thank you, Rhonda, and let me start by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri. I knew I'd have trouble with that, Joy, but thank you very much for your welcome this morning, the traditional owners of these lands. And I have to say thank you, Rhonda, particularly, and Joe, because it is a real privilege to have the opportunity to talk to such an amazing group as this. When I walked in this morning, I couldn't help but feel the sense of community. And I'm sure you all feel it. It's all natural to you. Sometimes in the business world, we wish for it. We don't feel it like you feel it here. Let me start by saying that I don't think there's any more appropriate time than to be debating the very premise of communities in control. And of course, the critical role of business in this. Both communities and businesses alike are being confronted with sustainability challenges on multiple fronts. And the evidence seems conclusive. We heard Tim this morning that if we don't change our ways, life as we know it is at fundamental risk from human activity itself. And at the same time, public trust in big business is pretty much at an all-time low. But it's not all bad news. The world has been getting better, both economically and socially. Not worse, as the anti-globalist movement would have you believe. Yes, the extremes are widening, but global incomes are becoming more equal, and we are seeing the emergence of a bulging middle class. More importantly, the proportion of the population, global population, living in extreme poverty is declining. That is, people living on less than $1 a day. It's dropped from 28% in 1990 to less than 20% just a decade later. And there's been an overall expansion in both political and civil freedoms. But despite the progress, current times nevertheless remain and are particularly challenging for both communities and for business. In the suburbs and the regions, people are feeling the stresses and they're feeling the strains. They're feeling a sense of powerlessness and a loss of control. So it's not surprising that we're finding the growing desire within communities to get back greater control of their own destinies. Yet inside the corporate walls, it sometimes feels like we're traversed to a different world, to another reality. A world where too often these community concerns and the broader sustainability challenges are viewed simply as someone else's problem. A distraction from the business of business and the prevailing profit maximisation dogma. The confusing and often misunderstood language of corporate responsibility has not been helpful, implying something foreign to the normal course of business, something of an optional extra. It provides a convenient escape hatch for those not wanting to be held accountable for the social and environmental blowbacks of their corporate activities. At its core, corporate social responsibility is all about enlightened self-interest. Enlightened in the sense that the interest of all stakeholders are considered and responsibility for the impacts of business activities are also accepted. It involves an understanding that business and its interests can't be separated from the society in which it operates and on which it depends. Confusion and misunderstood it might be, but the recent emergence of corporate responsibility, or what I prefer to call it as responsible capitalism, stands in stark contrast to the somewhat harsh and unbridled form of capitalism that is increasingly prevailing, or that has increasingly prevailed over recent decades. Like it or not, broader societal concerns currently struggle to penetrate the corporate veils, often shunted aside or ignored in favour of profit and shareholder wealth maximisation. Many, too many, seem to operate on the premise that the business of business is business and only business. The externalities of their business activities are simply something for someone else's care. But if communities are to be in control, and they should be, then the social goods necessary for a functioning and sustaining society need to be nurtured. And when the economic power of corporations is growing ever stronger and that of government ever weaker, we simply can't afford to have a large part of the corporate world to be detached from or seemingly at odds with this need. So little surprise that the role of business in society is now firmly on the table, in the spotlight. And the concerns and needs of citizens, which have largely been frozen out, are finding new voice. Attention is being focused correctly on the central question. The central question that has been on the table ever since the father of capitalism, Adam Smith, wrote his Wealth of Nations in 1776. And that is it possible for corporations to deliver on their fiduciary responsibilities to shareholders and at the same time serve the public interest in contributing to human, social and environmental capital? Or to put it more bluntly, will the unfettered pursuit of corporate profit without adequate attention to the public good ultimately set uncrippling and unnecessary limits on capitalism and on our society, making it less creative, less equitable, less dynamic and less sustainable? What is not always understood is that Smith in fact described a system based on enlightened self-interest and not one based on personal advantage at the ultimate expense of the common good. In his earlier work, The Theory of Moral Sentiments in 1759, he had underpinned his capitalist system with the virtues of justice, fairness and honesty, and he saw neither selfishness nor greed as virtues, and he regarded the spheres of human conduct, that is economic, social, moral and political, as interwoven and mutually dependent. Societies function best, Smith argued, when economic and ethical interests coalesce. So how did we end up with so much of today's corporate behaviour being at odds with that envisaged by the father of capitalism? Some of the answer can be traced back to the early influence of social Darwinism, a philosophy whose essence is that human societies function best when the principle of survival of the fittest is exercised to the maximum extent. Following this philosophy, a laissez-faire form of capitalism soon dominated, built on the belief that the market works best if unfettered by regulation or externally imposed obligation. Its popularity, however, dipped somewhat due to the social unpleasant consequences of depression and war, but it has made a resounding recovery in the last few decades. And the later day social Darwinists amongst us unite behind the shareholder primacy principle to reject ideas of corporate responsibility extending to civic and to common good responsibilities. At the same time, they seek even greater autonomy in decision making, despite what has already been a major shift in power from the owners, that is the shareholders, to boards and management. At the extreme, they go on to argue that fiduciary responsibilities and the law actually prevents them from considering the interests of stakeholders beyond shareholders. But the corporation law, in fact, contains no such legal constraint, nor is there any legal obligation to maximise profits or shareholder wealth for that matter, and certainly not in the short term at the expense of the long term. The legal and the fiduciary obligation, in fact, is to manage the company in the best interest of the corporation. The later-day social Darwinists, however, typically misrepresent this as an obligation to act in the best interest of shareholders alone and to exclude the interest of other stakeholders, such as the employees and customers. The problem, of course, is with this narrow and rather brutish form of capitalism, there's several. First, we have the agency problem, the growing gap between the interest of the owners on one hand and the managers on the other, which creates a vacuum of real ownership and the inevitable governance problems. And second, narrow self-interest and personal advantage inevitably get elevated to the status of core values. Little wonder then that we continue to see the unfolding stories of corporate scandals, frauds, accounting deceptions, subprime crises, and so on. All of them powered by outlandish greed and lack of ethics and such stunning regard for the public interest. One might wonder if those involved even recognise such a thing exists as the public interest. The unfortunate thing is that all business tends to get tarred with the same brush. And the widely held public view that all business is naturally opposed to the public good is a position that certainly does not accord with the actual practice of a great number of companies, including my own. And it is a position that is not sustainable. So having arrived at this worrying business and society crossroad, which path will we take? Will the corporate world opt for a more dynamic, creative and sustainable form of capitalism, a form where corporate leaders willingly lead beyond the walls of their corporation, a form where corporations readily accept accountability for the impacts of their business activities that affect the public interest, and where they actively contribute to community and to the common good? Or are new corporate laws and regulations the only way to ensure that we have the public goods required for social justice and for a prosperous society, as Robert Reich argued in his book Supercapitalism? Will governments need to get beyond the rhetoric and play a stronger, a more active role in dictating responsible business behaviour by innovating in the free marketplace whenever there is a societal case to do so? The problem with laws and regulations, however, is that they tend to be clumsy and blunt, typically targeting the lowest common denominator and often seeking to close the door or the barn door after the horses have bolted. Or, thirdly, will it be community-led activism, such as we're seeing here, ultimately driving the necessary step changes and action in corporate responsibility and sustainability? But whatever path we take, the warnings are clear. The great management thinker Peter Drucker didn't mince words when he said that unless the common good is adequately looked after, and corporations must be a big part of this, our society ultimately risks destroying itself just as all earlier plural societies destroyed themselves. But fortunately, standing at this business and society crossroads, we can see positive and helpful signposts. A growing number of leading companies, including my own, have shifted or are shifting their mindsets and rediscovering the true role of business in society. Progressive companies are out there raising the bar through new coalitions, groupings and initiatives. Initiatives such as the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, the Equator Principles, the Forestry Stewardship Council, the Principles for Responsible Investment, the Ethical Trading Initiative, the Australian Business Roundtable on Climate Change, to name just a few. Companies that are part of these business-led initiatives see the inevitable society paradigm shifts and want to be ahead of the game. Even the folk hero turned corporate monolith Walmart has come on board. On the back of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, Lee Scott, the CEO of Walmart, spelt a new leadership for Walmart in the 21st century. Environmental impact, community involvement, workplace practices and responsible sourcing were to be the new gateways for Walmart becoming the most competitive and innovative company in the world. It was a major change in stance. One of the true signals of the revolution in business thinking can be found in the July 2006 issue of Fortune magazine. The magazine ran a piece titled "The New Rules," claiming a dramatic rethinking was occurring in the fundamental drivers that had defined corporate success over the past few decades. Fortune's new rules are more about being agile, finding niches, looking out, not in, and the premise that the customer's king, not the shareholder, although, of course, shareholder interests remain fundamental. Nothing captured the shift more than Rule 7. The old rule was admire my might. The new rule, admire my soul. And having a soul, Fortune stated, is all about, and to quote, defining a company's vision in a sustainable long-term way and to hell with what the hedge funds and the other pay me now investors say, end quote. The sustainability of our rather brutish form of capitalism was already under renewed scrutiny from surprising quarters. Bill Emmett, the then editor of the Economist magazine, summed up the concerns when he declared that whether capitalism will survive was one of the most crucial questions for the 21st century. I think we kind of heard Tim say something similar. Emmett identified four flaws threatening its survival, namely, that capitalism in its current disguise was unpopular, unstable, unequal, and unclean. Not a great scorecard. Boards certainly have started listening when the Economist magazine itself, boards certainly should have started listening when the Economist magazine itself featured an article titled Pigs, Pay and Power, claiming that executive pay lay at the heart of capitalist troubles. As we've come to know it, however, modern capitalism makes no claim to providing equitable distributions of income and wealth, nor in itself does it care much for the environment. Its basic impulse is creative destruction. But we know that when pushed or threatened, people care mightily about equity and fairness and the environment, and that they are prepared to trade economic efficiency for it. This matters to business, or it should matter to business, because in any functioning democracy, the community license to operate is up for continuing renewal, and ultimately the community's voice gets heard. This means corporations need to demonstrate that in accepting the massive transfer of power from the public to the private sector that we've seen in the last 25 years, that they also accept additional responsibility that comes with it. Specifically, they need to show that they will use that power responsibly and in the interest of the entire community who grant this social license to operate. Community trust that they will do so has clearly not yet been won. Added to this, corporations, together with communities, remain increasingly challenged, as Tim pointed out better than anybody, by the national and global threats to our ongoing prosperity. So where to from here? How do corporations restore that community trust? And how do they successfully play their vital role with local communities in staring down these sustainability challenges? For a start, a more moral form of capitalism needs to be adopted, one where the interests of the firm are reconciled with the public interest. A form where the pursuit of corporate interests, the public interest is not lost, and neither are the principles of right and wrong. Or to use corporate speak, a form where the concept of corporate value reconciles the needs of the owners of the capital with those of the relevant stakeholders on which the ongoing viability of the business depends, and that includes the broader community. This is very doable. As I said, progressive companies are out there demonstrating and recognising and embracing concern for the impacts of their business activities on the public welfare. And they're finding this does not compromise their profitability. In accepting accountability for the externalities of their business activities, these companies are finding that they're taking risk out of their business, they're enhancing their social licence to operate, and thereby they're adding to shareholder value. Or to put it another way, they are finding that wonderful point of equilibrium that blends their corporate self-interest with the principles and values that accord with building stronger communities and looking after stakeholder interest. Or as Adam Smith would have put it, self-interest considered upon the whole. Were all firms to recognise this and make the necessary efforts, capitalism would be a more sustainable system, if anything, a more efficient one, and certainly one more uniformly admired. Encouragingly, there is now a growing view in equity and investment markets that this is in fact the right strategy. The message is increasingly clear. The pursuit of excellence in business does not require companies to forget their moral sense. Companies can do good and do well at the same time. And our corporate leaders are increasingly realising that businesses can't prosper in societies that are failing. And if you want to have prosperous and thriving high streets, you certainly have to have prosperous and thriving back streets. They go hand in hand. Or to put it another way, smart and progressive companies have realised that they need more than financial capital to prosper. They also need strong human, environmental and social capital. They realise that they cannot expect to sustainably increase their profitability if the so-called intangible value drivers such as employee commitment, innovation, brand reputation, customer satisfaction, environmental management, community involvement and so on are not being properly managed. Unfortunately, accounting conventions don't readily embrace such non-financial drivers and too often many just simply overlook or undervalue them as a result. So the second thing we need is for the concept of corporate value and the related accounting conventions to better embrace the full spectrum of both financial and non-financial capital. Thirdly, in order for the global business community to operate more ethically and morally, there needs to be commonly accepted principles and values. A decade ago, the Coe Roundtable codified a set of principles and guidelines to activate a moral sense in business. The Coe Roundtable's Principles for Business initiative was followed in 1999 by the UN's Global Compact, 10 principles that define corporate responsibility covering the areas of human rights, labour, the environment and anti-corruption. Today, there's around 4,000 corporations that have formally signed up to such principles. But many, many, many more have yet to publicly embrace these standards of behaviour and ethics that are so fundamental for social inclusion, strong communities and sustainable prosperity. Fourthly, if we are to sustain our companies and our society, more of our business leaders are going to have to get beyond the walls of their institutions and truly learn to create community. Adam Smith was right when he implied via his invisible hand that the intention of free and autonomous individuals would lead regularly and reliably to socially beneficial results. But both our corporate and our political leaders need to understand that it needs strong leadership to create the conditions for free and autonomous individuals within businesses and within societies. And corporations need to understand that economic activity is in fact cooperative activity and that the best capitalism involves cooperative activities, ethical principles and values that respect stakeholder interest. All of this will require innovation in corporate thinking, including around community partnerships, so that we can secure the vital role of strong communities and sustainable prosperity. The Westpac story over the past decade provides a vivid example of how this all plays out. An example of how social concerns, environmental sensitivity and innovation can lift a brand beyond the conventions of an industry and deliver more sustainable returns and improve public outcomes. It is not the only example in our industry, but I'm sure you'll excuse me for using it. Let me start with workplace practices, something that plays a big role in contributing to or detracting from social capital across the community. In the early 90s, the demographic realities of an ageing population, the inevitable war for talent, the increasing stresses of two-income households, including the challenge of balancing work and care responsibilities, were growing realities for both Westpac and its employees. The inherent workplace and employment risks to Westpac were clear, as were the broader societal issues. Consequently, we saw an opportunity to take leadership in implementing workplace reform. In 1995, we introduced paid maternity leave, followed by paid adoption leave in 1997, and then paid paternity leave in 1998. Yes, dads can be carers. This was followed with extensive workplace childcare initiatives and other childcare support. Not only did these initiatives materially lift employee morale, commitment and retention, they also delivered material community benefits in contributing to social capital. Critically, they were very positive for Westpac's bottom line. In fact, without them, one can argue that Westpac would not be as well positioned as it is today. Let me just give you one example of the financial benefits to Westpac. In the early 90s, the return to work rate following pregnancy was around 30% across Westpac, adding to a relatively high separation rate across the company. The return to work rate is now consistently in the high 80s to 90%, and our separation rate is consistently around 2% better or below industry averages. And when you consider that it costs us conservatively an average of $50,000 or more to recruit, train, accredit new staff members, not to mention the cost of loss of experience and so on, the business case was obvious. Savings, or should I say avoided costs, in excess of $50 million per year resulted. Perhaps an even more current example has been Westpac's action on climate change. In April 2006, together with five other companies, we released the Australian Business Roundtable on Climate Change report. The report called for urgent action to deliver large emission reductions, including the introduction of a market-based carbon pricing mechanism. Being prepared to stand up against the prevailing government and business views at the time was a pretty lonely space. But supported by others willing to speak out, such as Tim, and the undeniable science, by June 2007, this had become bipartisan policy. Business can do all sorts of things when it tries. That's the point. From its birth some 191 years ago, when Sydney was still a struggling penal colony, Westpac has inherently understood the positive benefits from community investment. The global best practice aspiration of investing 1% of pre-tax profits in community-based initiatives has been well established now for some time. And several Australian companies, including Westpac, meet the standard. Last year, in fact, Westpac's community contributions in Australia totaled some $52 million, or 1.3% of our Australian pre-tax profits. Added to this, and probably just as important, in excess of two-thirds of Westpac employees regularly volunteer in the community, and their volunteering is actively supported by the company with paid time off, etc. Last year, collectively, they also personally donated out of their own pockets in excess of $1 million to Australian charities, which was then dollar matched by Westpac. Since our matching gifts program was started in the late 1990s, some $15 million has now gone out to 1,100 charities across Australia through the individual efforts of our own employees. And a key part of Westpac's community involvement and is its community partnerships across the community and welfare sectors, Indigenous enterprise, rescue services, and so on. And I'm proud to say this includes a very active partnership with our community. Westpac's community partnership program is based on the premise that we can make a bigger impact on society by working closely with key community partners over the long term and by using our network resources and skills and expertise of our people. One plus one can make more than two when we work together. The Westpac example demonstrates the sort of community leadership that builds community and encourages faith in the capacity of business to play a leading role in strengthening communities and caring for the common good. The clear message from that story and from the many others I could have used is that the pursuit of excellence in business does not require capitalism to forget its moral sense. After all, the links between stakeholder responsive practices and shareholder value are pretty obvious and are particularly evident through improved reputational capital with both employees, customers and also the community, enhanced social license to operate, reduced regulatory and other operational risks, greater operational efficiency and more rapid responsiveness to changing societal trends, all of which go to enhancing stakeholder value both today and tomorrow. So it should be of no surprise that we find that corporations in the top decile of the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, such as Westpac, deliver on average over 50% greater return on capital, in return on invested capital, than companies who are in the bottom decile of the index. There is no question that corporations can deliver on their fiduciary responsibilities to shareholders and at the same time serve the public interest in contributing to human, social and environmental capital. Equally, there is no question that corporations will ultimately have little choice in this. And if you think I'm being overly alarmist about the need for corporations to act, one needs to look no further than the regulator's response to the business world ostrich-like reaction to earlier corporate excesses and governance failures. Community outrage at corporate inaction was inevitable, and it was followed by highly prescriptive governance and costly disclosure requirements. Surely, business this time around will be clever enough to regulate itself, and clever enough, one would hope, to see the interest in ensuring strong communities. Business can be the solution to the national and global threats much more readily than it can be the problem, and it can prosper from it. Business can stand shoulder to shoulder with the community in staring down these global and national threats. The path forward from the current crossroads, I believe, will be for business to show the innovation and the foresight to take moral and responsible capitalism from the fringes of the business model and firmly entrench it in the heart of everything that business does, as Adam Smith, the founder of capitalism, intended. Thank you very much.